You should. You know what? You should do it this time.
Oh, now that would mess things up. Hey, gang. It's July 10th, 2018. This is episode 324 of your On Taking Pictures program. Bill Wadman here in Brooklyn, Jeffrey Sidoris in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Oh, wait. How's it going, Bill?
This is On Taking Pictures. Wow, hello, I just messed people up for... They were probably upset about that. You sure you don't want to redo that? That's...
everything you said was correct. It is, in fact, July 10th.
Well played.
Yeah, it is. It is. You are Bill. I am Jeffrey. It is the show. So it's the second to the last show.
The penultimate episode.
Second to the last show. Remember, kids, next week, end of the line, Q&A show. Please send us in your questions.
Yeah. And remember, the more questions you send in, the longer the show will be, and the more On Taking Pictures you'll get.
If you send in 6,000 questions, we have to keep doing it, because we got to get through them all. They're like Pokemon. Your questions are like Pokemon.
Imagine if that actually is that's how we played it, and everyone actually did send in questions, and we had 15,000 questions to answer.
Every time there are questions, we have to just keep going.
Hey, I was going to ask you this, and it's an off-topic, on-topic thing for the show. Did you change your room at all recently?
No. Why?
Okay. Just because, like, the last few weeks, it almost sounds like there's a little more room tone in your recording that you send me. I was just wondering if you moved
I haven't changed anything.
Oh, interesting. Okay. All right. So maybe
could it be like levels? Like, should my levels be
no? Because it's more sort of direct versus reflected. You know, ratio of direct and reflected sound. It sounds like you're either a little further from the mic and you're getting more of the room tone because you turn up the gain a little bit, or maybe.
But if I turn this down a little bit, and I've got my mic. Foam pop shield instead of my screen one. Does one better than the other? This is foam. Foamy.
Yeah.
Here's the foamy. Let me take that off. And this is the screen. Screen, not foam.
I think screen sounds better than foam.
All right. Well, then we'll go with this.
Okay. Yeah. It's going to be that kind of day, guys.
Real time.
Real time microphone tests.
Sibilance.
So how's it going? Wait, have you pulled this thing out of this where we get this camera out of the box? Yeah.
Of course I have. Yeah. Oh yeah, I've been the Olympus. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so what do you think?
Okay, so if we can gear out for just a minute. I have not done the high-res test yet down the Smithsonian. We're doing that tomorrow.
Okay.
So tomorrow, for those of you who don't know, Olympus was kind enough to send me an EM1 Mark II and a 12-40 2.8 Pro lens, which is tack sharp. Oh, my God. Super, super sweet lens. We'll get to that in a minute. So one of the features that I have been most interested in about this camera is what they're calling their high resolution mode. And it takes a series of the camera is natively 20 megapixel. And in the high res mode, it takes a sequence of 8 shots by moving the sensor on a subpixel level and then composite stitches those 8 frames into one 50 megapixel frame.
They're not the only people who do this. Doesn't Panasonic do it?
No, Panasonic does it with the G9. Panasonic is claiming 80 megapixel, although in every comparison I've seen, it really is the same as the 50.
Right, and I think Pentax in the K1 that Alan has does it as
they've
well.
They've got a sensor shift. It works a little differently.
Yours work versus that?
I'm not sure. I've just read that it works a little differently.
The basic idea, though, is that you have these motors in there in order to compensate for 5 degrees of vibration reduction kind of thing.
Camera shake. Yeah, right. Sure.
So that you can use those as little actuators to move the sensor around by exactly one pixel in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or whatever, 8 different directions. And then you can basically interpolate higher res stuff by having that much more data. I think that's basically the gist, right?
It's stitching it all together. And I did some tests here at home, and they were fantastic. In fact, I printed a couple of my paintings because that's arguably why I want this feature. So the test tomorrow will be a couple things. It'll be the native 20 megapixel, the 25 megapixel high res mode, the 50 megapixel high res mode, and then we're benching that against the 80 megapixel Hasselblad and the 100 megapixel phase. Now, obviously, there are going to be some differences, and I would predict that the phase would be better from a number of reasons.
Right.
But I don't care what it looks like on screen at 400%. I care what it prints like.
Right.
So once I get all these done, I'll bring them home, and I'll print each file straight from the camera, no adjustments, right. No nothing. And if I can't tell a difference, then that lets me know, you know, where I'm at in terms of how this feature can benefit.
What you should do is when you print them out, write on the back what they are, put them on a table, have somebody else in the family flip them around. So, and then you choose best to worst and then go look at the results.
See
did you shoot the stuff that you test printed the other day? Did you also shoot it at the standard 20 megapixel mode and print that and put that next to the
high res mode?
I shot it,
but I didn't print it. There is a noticeable difference on screen. That's one of the things that
100% it should be, yeah.
Yeah, I thought about doing it, but I thought, you know what? I'm going to do it in a controlled environment.
Yeah. I would definitely do that too with it though, because I mean, if you're printing, say, on a 13 by 19 or whatever you're printing it on, or 11 by 14, it would be really interesting to see if anything beyond, say, 20 megapixels was even noticeable.
Does it make a difference?
Print. Yeah.
Does it make a difference? I don't know. Yeah. There are some really interesting features. The parallax, or I'm sorry, not parallax, keystone correction that's built into the camera is interesting. Yep. I mean, look, you can do it in post, and it's arguably probably more controllable in post, but it is kind of neat.
Does it do it automatically?
No, you've got control over it. The front and rear control dials become the two axes of correction.
Oh, interesting.
And you just dial in where you want it. I put a before and after shot on Instagram.
Oh, let me go find that. Okay.
It is interesting. I will tell you that there are more features in this camera than I will ever use. It feels great in the hand. No problems there. It's very fast. It's very responsive. But my X-Pro feels better to shoot with.
Yeah, I was about to ask how the handling is.
Yeah. Remember back many, many episodes ago where we would talk about the Prius as a vehicle, and it's when you're driving a car like that, you feel a little removed from it because it's you're telling a series of motors and actuators what to do rather than controlling actual surfaces.
Yep.
That's kind of the way this camera feels. It's very responsive, but I love the aperture ring on Fuji lenses. I love having the dials and you know, on my X-Pro there's one function button. That's it. On the OMD, I think everything can be customized. Every button and lever can be customized to your liking, which is wonderful if that's what you're into. Built-in curves is another interesting feature. You can dial in an S curve, a contrast curve, before you even take the photograph.
Right.
The video is beautiful. I have nothing bad to say about the camera.
Does it feel like a camera? Or does it feel like a computer? You know what I mean?
It feels like a camera in the hand. The grip is wonderful. I walked around with it, for example, all day yesterday in DC, without so much as a strap on it, and it just sort of hung there on my first three fingers, and the grip was just so comfortable, no problems whatsoever.
Right.
For the way I shoot and for the experiences I've had so far, it's very responsive.
Okay.
you know.
Battery life?
Really good, actually. Much better than my X Pro. Now, here's another sort of stick in the spokes. Fuji has the X-T3 is imminent. All signs are pointing to a launch or at least an announcement at Photokina this year. And so they have put the X-T2 on sale for $1,099 rather than the normal $1,599.
It's a lot of money saved.
That's a lot of money. So, you know, we're looking because Adrienne has decided that she would like another camera. She would like a new camera. Mm-hmm. She's using, I think, a Canon T2i.
Yeah, with a 50 on it, I think.
That's like dog years, man. That's a long time ago, right? That's even older than my camera. Mm-hmm. So, you know, who knows? Maybe I'll blow your mind and buy two X-T2s.
Whoa! I'm backing off with the mic here.
Back off, buddy.
Oh God!
Look, all of these cameras are so amazing.
Sure.
I mean, the people are. Oh, you don't get the depth of field on the Micro Four. You know what? Shut up. Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
You know, I was shooting a picture the other day of another photographer, and she said to me, you know, we were talking about my camera, and I was just saying, you know, for a lot of the people who end up using the pictures that I take, they're downsizing to use the pictures, of course. You know?
Sure.
But that there is, not only is there, you know, it's always, I always like, not, would rather have more information than less. There are advantages in post just in retouching and doing masks and that stuff. The more resolution you have to do a mask on, say, hair, the better the mask is going to be, the cleaner it's going to look. So there are sort of advantages in that realm, even if the final thing doesn't need to be that big. It's a little like doing, you know, shooting movies at 8K, even though the final thing's going to be 1080p or whatever. In the production process, it's always better to have more information, even if you reduce it down in the end, you know.
Right. But why? Okay, here's a question for you.
Yep.
Why carry around something that big when for probably 99 and some change percent of the work that you or anybody else does, frankly, mm-hmm. you could get a Sony A9 at, what are they, 43 megapixel?
The A7R3, I guess. The A9 is like 24, I think.
Is it?
Yeah, it's the A7R3 is 40 something megapixels.
Okay,
yeah.
So whichever one is the giant, you know, whatever megapixel.
Or right, yeah.
I mean,
I don't like the handling of those Sony cameras, so I will never use them.
Oh, but you do like the handling of the Pentax? Come on, it's a giant bra.
Giant camera, but using it is amazing. Like everything's where you want it. You know what I mean? Like the mm-hmm. actual using of the camera, and that's part of the reason why I carry it around because it's the camera I use, and I want to make it feel like that's natural when I actually have to use it for real stuff. You know?
Yeah.
The other thing, I mean, I end up cropping a lot of my stuff. So 40 something megapixels in a 3x2 ratio, I'm throwing a lot of the pixels away. So now you're down to a 30 megapixel file, you know, whatever. It's just a choice. I mean, yeah, it's big and heavy, but the big and heavy doesn't bother me that much. Plus the cost of having a whole other system, you know, I don't want a whole other system. I mean, if I was not going to use a medium format camera, I'd probably buy a Nikon 850 or something, you know? It's a great camera. There's nothing against it. I just, you know, I actually like the bigger camera that is not amazing at absolutely everything. It's, you know, the autofocus is slow. It's like, that's all fine because it makes me think about the pictures more than I do otherwise. That's why I carry it. But yeah,
I love the idea of an 850. I mean, if money were no object,
yeah, that's a great camera.
I would look at that very seriously because it's everybody that I know or have heard of that has one just raves about it.
Yeah, I've only ever used one for video last year on the farm. They had a few before they came out, and we were shooting video with them and. The video looked great, and you know, I mean, it would take me a couple months, I think, to get used to Nikon menu system because the paradigm is just, you know, just enough different from the Canon I was using for so many years that it would take me a few minutes to get used to it. But yeah, nothing that couldn't
apparently
be done.
They've got a at least one new mirrorless camera they're going to announce at Photokina.
Nikon
and Canon, actually.
I still have to send back this X70 that's sitting next to me that a listener let me borrow. But my ideal thing would be, I'll take the Pentax for when I need a big camera and for all those reasons. And then if it really had my druthers, I'd buy a little Leica digital because those are really nice. Because for the things that I just want to go out and enjoy taking pictures for, it's like, that'd be really nice, you know, mm-hmm. or even an X Pro 2, you know, like you were talking. It'll be interesting to see how your, how this little test goes, you know?
I'm excited about it. And I'm really grateful that, you know, I've got some friends that are willing to help me do it and have the kit to sort of donate to the cause.
Do you end up with a RAW file?
Yeah.
Out of the, even with the high res mode?
Yeah.
Okay.
RAW or JPEG.
One other thing you might want to consider doing is just to see, take the shots as you were and then underexpose them by a couple stops, all of mm-hmm. them, and see just to see the, or, and then maybe overexpose a couple stops just to see if the latitude of the different sensors is drastically different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That would be an interesting test while you have them all set up anyway. Take 30 seconds and take a couple of other exposures.
I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be interesting.
Are you taking over DP review?
No. So look, the Nikon, I just found the thing. The Nikon's supposed to announce two new mirrorless cameras, one at around 24 megapixel and the other one somewhere between 45 and 48 megapixel.
So using that same sensor, that Sony
stabilization
sensor.
4K video, 8K time lapse, 9 to 11 frames per second.
F mount,
yes.
Interesting. So basically they're going to make a Nikon version of the Sony bodies.
In fact, even the people in the know have said the body size is similar to the
Sony A. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who would have ever thought, if you said to us 6 years ago when we started this show, that Nikon would be chasing after Sony in camera design?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Somebody suggested a possible name for it is the MF, which I think is kind of genius. The mirrorless F. I think that would be
interesting.
Super cool branding.
The MF.
I don't know if that's what it stands for, but yeah. Yeah.
What, you know, this is a little side tangent.
Yep.
When it comes to people talking about the new model of something, do you like dates? Do you like Photoshop 2018 or do you like Photoshop 10 or whatever?
Well,
do you have an opinion on that?
I think now with dev cycles, what they are, it seems to be easier to know when something was released if you just use the date.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look, if you go back, look at cars for a minute.
Yeah,
one of the reasons that like the 911 from Porsche or some of the Mercedes models that they didn't change body styles and the numbering convention or the naming convention didn't change from model year to model year. It's one of the reasons they held their value. You could look at a 1971 911 or a 1984 911 and be hard pressed to find a difference.
Right. But you also have the weird 911s, like the 964 and the 997, and you know what I mean. Like
those are different body designs. They're different cars. But yeah. the 911. In fact, let me look and see. Porsche 911. What were the model years that car has been made? Porsche 911 two door started in 1963.
Right. But look, are you on the Wikipedia page?
Yeah.
Yeah, but scroll down in the content. See, it's like even the high-end ones, like the GTs and stuff, have a different numbering scheme to them. See what I'm talking about? There's the 930, and those are all inside of the 911 overarching thing. It's just very... It's the whole way of naming things is just really weird to me.
Neat cars. So my dad had a 911.
Well, you know, look at Chrome. You use Chrome. You're a Safari guy, aren't you?
Yeah, I don't like Chrome.
Okay.
I've started using the new Firefox.
And do you know what version of Firefox you're using right now?
Oh gosh, it's the what are they calling it?
Right, but do you know what the number is of the version you're using?
Maybe 19.
Well, see, that is the thing, right? Is that we are all using for browsers, we don't even think about it.
Oh no, it's Chrome. The latest
Firefox
release
Quantum is number 60. Version 60.
Yeah.
And Chrome is version some other, it's like version 57 or something
So I'm way off. I don't know.
Yeah, 67. The latest Chrome. So there's certain things where we don't even care about that kind of stuff. And when it comes to cars, there's the weird thing, Jeffrey, where it's you know, the style changed in 2011 through 2015, and then it changed again in 2016. So a 2014 and 2015 look the same. A 2015 and 2016 don't. You know what I mean? That kind of weird model year stuff that car people do.
I think kind of the most, I don't know, maybe the most similar comparison to that would be Sony.
Yeah.
Where you've got the A7, you got the A7II, the A7III, the A7R3, the A7S3, the A7A, you know, like, how do you...
Yeah, because people from the outside think that we're crazy when we talk about that kind of stuff. You know, what is the Olympus camera you just got handed?
EM1 Mark II.
Right.
But then there's also the EM10 and the EM10 Mark II and the EM10 Mark III.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
and the upcoming EM5 Mark III, and after that, there'll be probably an EM1 Mark III.
And technically, it's the Olympus OMD EM1 Mark II.
Yeah.
What the hell does that mean? Who is OM? What's D? Why are there D and E? Is it D or is it E? And why are there... It's the M1 Mark II. Isn't the M1 stand for Mark I? This is the insanity that I'm talking about.
That is a good question. Blowing my mind right now. I'm having to rethink all I know.
A snake just ate its tail in Jeffrey's brain.
Yeah, I'm just, I don't even know where to go now. What show is this?
Sorry for the tangent. That's the kind of thing I've been thinking about lately. It just goes in circles in my mind, man.
Well, and then Adobe goes, well, it's Lightroom CC. No. I'm sorry. I meant Lightroom Classic CC.
Yeah. CC Classic or whatever. Yeah. Then you go suddenly add a classic stamp to something, and then you completely change the product that was named the thing for many years, you know?
Right.
I mean, that's... And then Adobe is launching a new video editor. Do you know this new video
editor? Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's not Premiere. It's a completely different branch from Premiere Pro?
Yes, it's called
Rex. They should just call it Ron. New Adobe Ron.
Project Rush.
What? I like it already.
Ding 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 ding. Adobe. This was June 19th. Adobe today launched announced the launch of Project Rush, a new video editor that takes the core features of its Pro Tools like Premiere Pro, After Effects, and Audition, combines them into a single, more accessible tool. Don't get excited yet, though. Many new tools will only be available later this year. My guess would be the launch of the company's Max conference in October. Target audience of Rush is the average YouTube creator who's looking for a professional-looking result and to do so fast because the expectation of the platform is for regularly pushing out new content. Rush wants to become the all-in-one video editing app for creating and sharing online content. And to do so, the team decided that it had to ensure that Rush was available on any device, Jeffrey, no matter whether it's a high-powered desktop or an iPhone. All projects are automatically synced to the cloud, so you can work from anywhere. Yeah, I want to sync my Blackmagic footage over a cable modem. In building Rush, Adobe decided to leverage its technology that it already developed for its professional tools. That means that when you tweak a video clip's color, for example, you're using the same underlying algorithms as a video editor works in Premiere. Rush will also support motion graphic templates for building title sequences and graphs in videos, and it'll use the company's AI tools for improving the audio of video clips. There's also an integration with Adobe Stock, so you'll have stock footage available to spice up your video, etc., etc. The demo looks pretty intuitive, quite a bit more like iMovie than Premiere, etc.
Hmm.
I mean,
there should be three modules.
Because there's three members of Rush?
Yes. a progressive new video editor.
It's so prog rock. Got it. That's cute. But I mean, I think a lot of these old time companies, I was going to say oldie timey companies like Adobe, who would have thought I'd say that?
Right.
These entrenched companies are like, man, even though, you know, a lot of big serious people are using Premiere to edit movies and stuff, that's not really the market. The market is the billion people with an iPhone, you know, and them moving up and down the line.
Sad,
easily.
But true.
So,
yeah.
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 My buddy Claude Bashinger was talking at Adobe, or not Adobe, Adorama does a week-long thing here in New York. Maybe it's 2 weeks, where they have different companies give talks and show off products and stuff. And Claude was asked to talk about this tripod that has a fluid head and, you know, all these different features. And basically the gist of what he said was, listen, you need to know how to use a fluid head, how to balance a camera on the head and all the rest of it in order to do this. You can buy this tripod for $500 and get used to working this way. And then if you get put on a tripod that's $5,000, it works the same as the one that's $500. It's not like you jump up to the higher one. You know, if you handed your average person who uses an iPhone to take pictures, if you handed them a phase one camera, I don't know that they would know what to do. You know? Where this is basically saying, no, it's just like your iPhone, except we have a 100 megapixel sensor in here. By the way, Phase also makes a camera that does the shifting, or Hasselblad does, right?
Hasselblad makes one. It does, I think it's either, is it 200 or is it 400 megapixel?
Yeah. But there's this sort of, we want a ubiquity across the entire line kind of stuff that I think is becoming more common, at least in the software field.
Right.
Of, you know, whether you're using it on anything. I you know, am not the right use case for, say, the new version of Lightroom that everyone keeps talking about, because I just have too many images and I don't need to work on them on my iPhone. But, you know, I guess this is where the world is going. I don't know if it means better tools for people who really want to work, or if it just means that everything gets watered down. It's the lowest common denominator.
I think you can't look at, and I've been thinking about this a lot in this whole camera thing, especially since I got the Olympus. I don't think you can look at the totality of a product, whether it's a hardware or a software product, and make a decision on whether it's right for you based on all of the features. I think that you need to zone in on the features that are going to make or break your workflow, or the features that are going to apply to whatever it is that you're trying to do. For example, in the case of the Olympus, the big feature about this camera that makes it stand out for me is the high res mode. If I can do even a half or three quarter, if the 50 megapixel mode on this looks, you know, better than a standard 24 megapixel sensor, but not quite as good as a 100 or even an 80 megapixel sensor, then that feature becomes a viable feature for my workflow.
Yep.
Never mind all the other things that the camera will do, because the long and short of it is if you compare, let's say, this camera, which is arguably the flagship Micro Four Thirds camera, some people are going to say the G9, but they're very similar in many respects, to the flagship APS-C camera, which would be probably the X-T2. You know, they're very hard, let's say under 6400 ISO. Okay, let's qualify it with that, because you can't really get around physics. But under 6400 ISO, you would be hard-pressed to tell one camera from the other in terms of output, either JPEG or RAW or indeed a print.
Yep.
So it comes down to cherry-picking those features that are going to satisfy your needs. Because like Photoshop, for many years, they said that, you know, 90% of the users use 10% of the features.
Yeah.
So
the problem is,
what do you
each,
care?
Each person uses a different 10%.
A different, arguably, yeah.
Yeah.
So what has been helpful in the way I'm starting to see products, whether they are hardware or software, is don't look at all that they can do. Look at what they can do for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And not just your needs, but your desires, right?
Yeah.
I've had this theory lately, which is no one in your life can be everything. You need to realize that everyone has strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, if your business partner or whatever it is no good at, I don't know, whatever, business development or something like that, but he's really good at making the thing, whatever. Well, then you maybe need to bring in somebody who fills that void. You know what I mean? But that's okay. It doesn't mean that not everything needs to be 100% of everything. You know, there's no one camera that's going to be right for everybody. Right.
No.
And in fact, in some ways there's no camera that's going to be 100% right for any one person. You know, I love my camera. Is it big? Yes. Is that something I can deal with? Yes, I'm fine with that. I was talking to a guy the other day.
For the type of work that you do.
For the type of work
that I do.
If
you were a street photographer and carrying that around.
It's not the right camera.
It's not the right camera.
Right. Yeah. And you know, I was talking to a guy the other day who shot a project on the Hasselblad, the X1D, the little guy.
The little aluminum one?
Yeah.
The little, yeah.
And I had my camera with me, and he picked it up, and he's just like, he took a couple of pictures. He goes, ugh. He's just like, yeah. He says, I've thought about this camera, and now holding it, he's like, that feels like a camera. I was like, yep. And that's why I use it. It's a little slow. It's a little old. It's whatever. But you know what? It feels like a camera. I said, is that blackout time on the hospital? He goes, oh, it was awful. He goes, I thought there were times that I was going crazy. I was just like, have I gone blind for a half a second? You know, and this is a guy who was using it for a project. And he's like, yeah, I mean, the output's great. But, you know, he ended up doing the same thing I did, which is changing the metadata on it so he could edit them in Capture One because, you know, that he really hated the Hasselblad software. So it's like, even if it might be the right thing for you, or on paper it might be the right thing for you, or somebody else loves that and that's what they use, if you use it and it doesn't work for you, then all bets are off. You know, it's just like there's nothing you can do about that.
Right.
Do you think that, let's say you decided, okay, that's it, I'm going to buy this camera, right?
Yep.
Which, by the way, if you go and buy the Fuji, you'd lose out on that high res mode, right? The Fujis don't
you
have that.
You lose out on the high res mode, but you gain in other areas. You gain better continuous autofocus. You gain,
Right. Do you use those things, though?
I don't use them now, and I don't know that I would use continuous autofocus. For the video stuff that I've got coming up, because I think the way it sits right now, it's two cameras, and one's going to be locked. Actually, both of them are going to be locked down on tripods, and then some pickups to get detail shots and things like that, which I'm fine if those kind of wander in and out of focus a little bit,
right,
as long as they're stable. And that's where the Olympus really shines, is the stabilization it's almost voodoo. I mean, it really is like,
right,
you know, you can pan and move and walk, and it's akin to being on a gimbal.
That's weird.
It really is weird.
And do you think, though, if you had that camera tomorrow, that you would paint more? You see what I'm saying? Like, but your ability to record them at high res or whatever, is that a missing piece in your...
No, I don't think it's a missing piece, because I have a way around it now. Again, I've got, you know, friends that are thankfully willing to help me out every now and again. Now, is that a welcome that's going to get worn out if every few weeks I go, hey, I've got a few more things, would you mind scanning? Yeah, I don't want to take that chance.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
I would do it maybe once or twice, but I don't want to assume or, you know, inconvenience someone to help me out when, you know, I can get the tools to do it myself. Now, look, here's the thing. If I shoot a 24 megapixel shot of one of my paintings and print it out at 11 by 14,
right,
even 16 by 20, Is it going to look, you know, better if I've got an 80 megapixel file? Probably not at that size.
Right.
You know, I think the native the native print size on the high res mode in the Olympus is, I want to say 25 by 34.
Right.
Whereas the 20 megapixel, I think is 1114.
Something around there. Yeah.
You know, because it's like 51 and change across on the long end on the 20, but the high res mode is 10,400 something or 10,300 something on the long end.
Right.
So, you know, is it a good feature? Yeah, if it works. Right now with the X-T2 on sale, is it worth $600 for that feature? I don't know. You know, I do love the Fuji color science. I love the Fuji navigation. The menus are intuitive. The ergonomics of the camera are great. I will tell you, I prefer the non-fully articulating LCD screen.
Yep.
I like the one that just sort of rotates down to give you – I don't need a selfie thing.
Yeah.
And even when you're using it as a waist level finder, you've got to have the thing out to the side of the camera, and I don't find that very intuitive. It just doesn't feel right.
Takes you out of it.
Yeah. There's no touchscreen on the X-T2, but my nose hits or my cheek or whatever, so I turn the touchscreen off anyway. So
yeah, and you already have a lens, so.
And let's face it. I mean, right now, circa late 2018, mid 2018, none of the touchscreens on cameras are worth a damn.
Oh man, I'll tell you. So somebody asked me what I thought about this, the little X70. And yeah. One of the things that because it's only a touch, or it's only the screen on the back. You basically shoot it like an iPhone.
Yeah.
And you can touch.
But the iPhone is way more responsive.
Yeah.
Well, on the touch screen anyway.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
But the crazy thing about it is that I have, say somebody's sitting somewhere and I tap on their face to say, okay, yeah, focus over there. And I half press and it says it's in focus and I take some pictures and I come home and only one of them isn't focused on the wall behind them, 6 inches behind them.
Yeah.
It's like, guys, it's a person. You have all this technology that knows what people look like and faces and finds those and whatever it is. At least 2/3 of the pictures I've ever taken with this camera were out of focus from where I wanted them to be.
I will say I do love, and I don't know if other manufacturers do this, but I do love the manual focus implementation on this camera. There's a clutch on the pro lenses. You pull back on the clutch. Now you're actually focusing the lens. It's not focused by wire.
Oh, yeah.
And you can set it to where when you move the focus barrel, now the EVF snaps to 100% with focus peaking.
It is
very fast to focus manually.
Yep. Yeah, that's how all of it. That is one of those. There's an example of, oh, we have an EVF. What can we do with it? Oh, right. Well, you can do this thing with it.
Bill, why is Fuji the only company that makes an EVF that rotates when you put the camera in portrait mode?
Right. This one doesn't.
No, nobody does. To my knowledge, Fuji's the only one that does it.
Because these people think you'd be confused by it. Hey, your ratio of your paintings is, what size do you normally make them at?
16 by 20, 18 by 24. I've got a couple 24 by 24 canvases that are ready to go.
Right. So in
and
some
I'm
ways,
doing a big one for over the sofa.
You end up throwing away a lot of pixels, shooting them 2x3.
Yes.
See, there's another sort of downside. At least the you're gonna have to be careful or do multiple tests because the medium format cameras will be more close in ratio to yours, so they'll have a my point is that if you place the camera so that you optimized for the sensor, mm-hmm. you're going to get more detail in those because you'll be able to get closer with those because the ratio is better. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right Yeah, I'm gonna have to set it up so. And I don't know if these cameras, if the phase, can you do a 4:3 crop in camera?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, they're 3x4 probably built in.
So then they're the same as the Olympus. So the same aspect ratio as Olympus.
Oh, the Olympus is a 3x4.
Yeah, micro 4/3.
Oh, right. I guess it is. Yeah. I always think of those guys as 3x2, like a 35 millimeter.
No, 4:3. So it actually might be closer than I could get.
Yeah, it actually might be exactly the same.
Yeah.
Yes, it would be better than you would get on like a Fuji.
On a 3:2. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see. You know, it's interesting. But it's, you know, all of this stuff has gotten me thinking about needs and wants and even analog, you know, as I, you know, we're going to start the studio build out finally. And that's on me. That's not on Adrian. She has been at the very least encouraging, at the very most insistent that we get this done. And I've been the one dragging my feet. So I think we're going to do it this weekend.
What's been the delay?
My head.
What is it? Are you worried you're not going to do it right the first time, or you're going to be?
I don't know. I just haven't been able to decide on exactly how I want it. But I think we've decided on a plan moving forward, and I'm going to move downstairs entirely. So I'll take over the two studio spaces downstairs. One will be painting, and one will be computers and podcast. And then the room that I'm in currently upstairs will be a guest room.
So that interesting.
You know, family and friends come over, they have some place to lay their weary heads.
Ah, okay. Are you going to miss the sunlight?
No, because I have everything blocked out anyway.
Oh, okay.
Sunlight.
I just pictured, like, cut to you sleeping in a coffin, like, yeah, opening right. It up, like...
Now, I think it's going to be good down there. It will be nice to have both spaces adjacent to one another.
Yeah. You got to have a ventilator in the painting room?
There will be, yeah. There will be an exhaust fan.
Yeah. I always wonder about that. Because
the paint
gives me headaches.
The acrylic stuff, it's I don't use anything that's toxic anymore. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, when I was doing some of the early stuff, I was still using like MEKP and bronzing powders and really nasty stuff.
But even
I
just also the fumes from the acrylics have like can give you headaches and make you a little no?
Yeah, I guess. I take breaks a lot. And I if I'm gonna be doing something for long periods of time, I do wear a respirator.
Ah, there you go. I think you should do a selfie with you with a respirator on.
I have one. It's terrifying. It's like a Breaking Bad nightmare.
Yeah, you're cooking meth down there.
I'm serious because I've got my Tyvek suit on, so it's like the Tyvek suit and my safety goggles and my you know my respirator. It's awful.
Dan came and helped me on one of those Eating Well shoots at a place that was like this indoor farm kind of thing where they grow lettuce in this sort of almost fleecy kind of material under LED lamps 24 hours a day.
Fleecy material?
Yeah, it's not soil. It's kind of like this like sponge fleece kind of stuff.
Huh, interesting. I haven't seen that. I've seen they're these German pellets that are, they're like, they look like Cocoa Puff cereal.
Oh, yeah. So it's sort of like giant soil is what you're kind of thinking.
Yeah.
No, this is almost like growing it in, there's no soil at all. To the point where when they pull the lettuce, Jeffrey, they put it right into a bag. They don't even have to wash it because it's in a clean room.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's really cool. Anyway, to go shoot this guy, both Dan and I had to walk through. We had to sign all this crazy paperwork that said, you know, not only have we cleaned our shoes and blah, 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 blah. And I had actually been on farms, which is the worst possible situation for them, right? Because any spores that get in, any whatever.
Oh, yeah.
So I had to actually take my pelican into the tub and scrub it down with bleach water.
Oh, wow.
To, like, make sure that there was absolutely no dirt contamination on it.
No kidding.
Yeah. So we go there and we have to, there's like pools that you step through. So it's like you step through a water chemical bath and you go onto a drying one and then through another chemical bath and then a drying one, and then had to wear full suits, gloves, plastic, you know, rubber gloves.
Where is this place?
Hats. It's in New Jersey, in Trenton. Wow. Not in Trenton, in Newark. And then hats and face masks, like full. I mean, it was like, or a hairnet. Jeff, Dan had to wear, because he has a beard, so he had to wear a beard net and a hairnet. So we looked like, wow. Oh, and goggles too. We had to wear goggles, like glasses. So basically, we're Intel, you know, bunnies suit kind
right.
of thing,
right?
To go into what is technically a farm.
Wow, that is fascinating.
Yeah, it was really cool, but and I'm I would have told this story earlier, but I couldn't because I couldn't let on who this person was. But anyway, but this guy, Mark Oshima, and his partners have developed this crazy farming thing because there's places in the world, say down in the Middle East, where they have lots of power because they can set up solar things in the desert or whatever.
Right.
But they have no arable land.
Yeah, you can't grow lettuce and sand.
Right. We can build a box in the desert. We have power. We can put up these LEDs and you can grow. Apparently, a head of lettuce generally takes 30 days to grow. They can do it in 13 days because they're doing it 24 hours a day.
No way.
It's growing 24 hours a day.
You can hear it grow.
Probably. You can sit there and watch it grow. And then they have these, there's racks that are stacked from floor to ceiling 50 feet up. So it's these giant sort of like server rack looking things that go up 50 feet. And they're having a slight incline so that the liquid, you know, so water can go through them.
Right.
And feed the whole thing. It's really amazing. But the reason I bring it up is that we had to put on all this crazy stuff. So I have these pictures of Dan in this crazy bunny suit with a beard thing on. But yeah, it's crazy. The some of the stuff that you have to wear to get into these places. Sometimes the security of taking a picture is just as interesting as actually taking the picture, getting into the building and dealing with the, you know, logistics of everything. You should see the forms I had to fill out to shoot people in London.
Oh, I bet.
The building had all kinds of crazy EU things. Are you plugging in? How much do your stuff weigh? How high is it going up? How many amps does it pull? I'm like, I don't know. I'm like looking up specs on the lights. You
42.
Know? Yeah, 42 amps. You know,
it's like a car battery. Here, hook this up.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that there's an advantage to bringing stuff that's battery powered because you don't have to worry about that.
Right.
You know, friends of mine who are musicians, in some buildings, you have to have special insurance liability kind of things. If you're plugging in, if you're not plugging in, you don't have to have that insurance. So they use battery powered amps so they don't have to worry about that. So there you go.
Huh. Something like that guy down in Venice Beach.
Yeah. Is there a guy down in Venice Beach?
Yeah. World famous guy. He wears a turban and a white outfit.
Oh, I don't know that I know this guy.
And he's on rollerblades.
Oh, that guy, the guy, basically a Fletch.
Harry Perry. Is what you're talking is his about. Name.
Yeah, Harry Perry. Look at that. I'm gonna put
born
a
in
the
Washington D.C. Shut up.
He probably comes and hangs out. Ah, see, their cameos include Fletch, which makes perfect sense.
Used to see him all the time down there.
Yeah, there's there are these new, talk about like weird technological things. Those friends of mine use this little Roland amp, and it'll run for 8 hours, Jeffrey, on, wait for it, 4 AA batteries.
Oh, wow.
Which I don't understand. It must be one of those like class D amps, like a digital switching amp, like that it doesn't need a whole rail of power all the time. It just sort of, you know, digitizes amplification, you know, right. it's a fast enough pulse that it's really a pulse based amplification system. It's just whether or not the pulse is on or off or not, you know, cause there's no possible way you could have that kind of efficiency in anything. My phone can't play a podcast for 3 hours. How the hell is this thing supposed to run for, you know, play loud for 8 hours?
Thanks, Apple.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for making it thinner.
Really, really enjoy that. I like the way it bends but doesn't stay charged.
Oh, thanks. Did you end up buying a new one this year?
No, I have 6S.
Okay,
I'll have to. They're gonna stop supporting it when the next iteration comes out.
You and I are both 6S guys who are waiting for upgrades this year. I think it's gonna be a big year for upgrades.
All around.
I mean, and I think that you and I will see 3 years, man. That's where you see big changes.
I think so. Yeah, I think this the cameras that they're talking about are you know, night and day difference in terms of efficiency and speed. Maybe not night and day, but dramatic.
Yeah.
RAM has gotten exponentially faster in those 3 years or 4 years.
Yeah. Interesting. Wow, we're going long. Let's talk about Squarespace for a minute there. Hey, remember
where are we at? Oh, wow, we are. Look at that. This is like a Seinfeld episode. We've spent an hour talking about nothing.
We actually talked about cameras for an hour.
Wait, what now?
Which is actually talking about nothing. If you've got lots of pictures and you want to show them to the world, Jeffrey, you should use Squarespace to build a website. Build a beautiful website. See what I did there? Beautiful.
I see. Oh, so that's their tagline. Build it beautiful. Okay. Clever.
See? You need to showcase your work and blog and publish content, sell products and services of all kind, promote your physical or online business, announce an upcoming event or special project, which, you know what, while we're here, I'm going to mention something that I'm doing in next week, 2 weeks.
So it's that nude interpretive dance thing?
Yeah, exactly. On the 19th, I am presenting at a thing called Projections, which is a...
appropriately titled.
Yeah, exactly. Which is a photography thing where photographers come in and show off their works and talk about them for 20 minutes. And I think there's three or four different photographers speaking that night. And I'll put a link in the show notes because there's an Eventbrite thing. I think you could just register and come. It's Thursday, July 19th, 6:30 to 9:30. At Photo Shelter's headquarters in Union Square. But I will put a link in the show notes. And if you want to come say hi and hear me talk for 20 minutes about my work, you are welcome to do that. So anyway.
Or you could go back and listen to him talk about it for 600 hours.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Womp womp. But that's the kind of thing I should put as a little header on my website, which I will do after this, using that cool little header feature that... that announcement bar thing that Squarespace has. They've got beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online. You could do ebooks, you could sell physical products, you can link to stuff on Amazon. You can also have
hold
the ability-
on now. You what? Can link to stuff?
Yeah. But actually, those Amazon blocks are actually pretty cool because you can add an Amazon are. Block to the page and then search for Olympus AMD OM1 Mark III ANC 27, and you will get that link to that product, and people will can give you affiliate money. That's pretty handy. Everything's optimized for mobile right out of the box. And you've got a new way to buy domains, too, at Squarespace. You could choose from over 200 extensions. So you can go buy your domain there, add it to your website, and have everything all in one place. Their analytics are great. They help you grow. They show you how to grow in real time by showing you where people are coming from, what they're looking at. So that's really handy to figure out where your viewers are coming from. Built-in search engine optimization so that people can find you on the big search engines. Free and secure hosting with nothing to patch or upgrade ever. So, you know, you get your Squarespace account. They deal with all the back-end stuff. They deal with all the patching and upgrading and making sure your security is tight. And they've got 24/7 award-winning customer support over at Squarespace. And they're fantastic. It's by chat or email. And so go make it yourself with Squarespace. Create your own website all by yourself. You don't need to know how to code. Although if you want to do a little CSS stuff, you can do that. And you can optimize whatever you want to do. So think it, dream it, make it with Squarespace. Go check out squarespace.com/OTP for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code OTP to save 10% off your first purchase of a domain or a website with our friends at Squarespace. Thanks so much to Squarespace for supporting 5x5 and On Taking Pictures for so many years.
Many years.
They were one of our first people, and we love them.
I think they were the first, weren't they?
Yeah, I think maybe we did a little Red River Paper stuff before then.
Maybe.
But they were... Yeah, but
I love the Red River Paper.
Yeah, we should see if Red River Paper will sponsor our last episode.
I wonder if, you know what, I'm going to have to send an email because I know that they were looking at trying to bring back version one
of San Gabriel Semigloss.
San Gabriel Semigloss. So I will send Drew an email and see if there's any movement on
that. Is that the paper that... That never dies, that is going to live in infamy.
In infamy, the San Gabriel Semigloss. I mean, I love that paper. And if there was not a San Gabriel Semigloss 1.0, the 2.0 would probably be a pretty good paper. But yeah. Having seen the 1.0 and used it and loving it, I miss it.
On a slightly separate thing, I'm sending you a link in Skype. I know we're all over the place today, but I want to ask you about this. Have you ever seen chair like this? I'm sending you a link to the
Hag in Skype?
Capisco chair. Yeah, I sent you a link in Skype. It's like one of these chairs that you can sit in all different ways. You can sort of, it's an office chair.
Oh, I have seen these. Yeah. You can, yeah, you can sit four ways, back ways, or sideways.
Yeah. Have you ever actually sat in one?
No. I've never seen one in person. I've only ever seen them like in catalogs or online.
So they charge like $700 for these chairs, but if you also buy a desk from there, and they sell the Jarvis standing desk, including one that's crank, so you don't even have to have the motor and plug it in, it's like $200 off the chair if you're also buying a desk. And I was just wondering if you had any experience with that.
Said, I've seen them.
Yeah. Okay.
But I've seen them in you know, online or in print, but I've never seen one in person.
Okay. So
the,
if anybody,
the base looks interesting.
Yeah.
With the little foot pegs or foot pads, rather.
Yes.
Yeah. Hag Capisco. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah. Capisco chair.
Huh.
If anybody out there has ever used one of these things and wants to chime in and let me know, send an email to podcast.taking pictures, because I'm interested to see if they're actually as good as, you know, the advertising makes them out to be. I need a new chair. I've had my, talk about buying something and having it last for a while. I've had my Aaron chair, my Herman Miller chair, for 19 years.
Yeah.
And it still works.
Still works.
I mean,
and when the dot-com bubble burst, you could buy them for $100 a piece.
Right. I paid $600 for mine, or whatever the hell it cost at the time. Yeah. But you know, good product. All right. Can we get a little deep here for a minute?
Yeah. Do we have time? I mean, we don't. I guess we do. Yeah, we do.
We'll talk a little bit, and then we'll see where it goes.
Yeah.
So last week we used photographer Don McCullen for our photographer of the week.
Yes.
Who was a war correspondent photographer kind of guy, the kind of guy we've talked about numerous
combat
times.
Combat photojournalist. Yep. Yeah, Vietnam.
And can you put succinctly sort of the feelings he has had lately about his work?
Yeah, I mean, this went back. I think the first thing I saw, it was either it might have been a Guardian piece. But basically, Don was talking about, you know, that he's had this 50 year life of documenting the worst parts of humanity, documenting war, documenting suffering, documenting pain, and readily admits that. You know, that was what drove him. Here, there's one article that I had. This is from the Globe and Mail. Let's see. It's a passion I cannot describe. Let's see. Yeah. I love world affairs, McCullen told me, and I didn't want to learn about it from the bullshit of an artful politician. So bearing witness is important to him. Then there's a deep love of photography. It's a passion I cannot describe, he disclosed.
Yeah.
For McCullen, these two motivating factors intersect in a war zone. There, lying in wait is the seductive exhilaration that comes from taking risks, often extreme, in search of a scoop laced with danger. A double shot of adrenaline, as it were. A restless drive to photograph conflict that has seen him work in every major 20th century war zone, the Falklands apart since the Cyprus conflict of 1964. But what he says something. War's sickness had become mine, he confessed. And yet he returned repeatedly to the fray, no doubt in tune with the sentiment expressed by an unknown source. Call war damnable. There's nothing too bad that can be said about it. And yet it has a knack, which peace never learned, of uncovering the splendor in commonplace persons. But, you know, he got to a point where and again, I'm making some assumptions based on what I've read and watched.
Sure.
But it seems like it was a life wasted for him. that the last thing that these people needed was a camera in their face when they'd just been shot or, you know, macheted or, you know, gotten hit with punji sticks or, you know, whatever it was.
Right.
The last thing. Rather than take pride in this remarkable, McCullen bemoans what he sees as the photograph's unfortunate fate. I have come to hate it, he complained. And then it's this particular photograph of this Marine taken during the Tet Offensive. It is too famous, too symbolic. It has become a piece of artwork. People want to buy it. These objections will again be ignored, such as the power of war, destroyer of men. And, you know, he now photographs flowers and landscapes in the English countryside because he can't unsee the things that he's seen. He can't unphotograph the things that he's photographed, and he's reminded of the callousness of the human condition every time he looks at them.
Right, right.
And we last week when we were talking about this, it was within the context of you know, not getting the life you dreamed of and making course corrections. But what happens when you get the life that you dreamed of? You get the life that you worked hard for, but at the waning years of that life, you realize it's all for nothing, that you realize that it was a life wasted.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, imagine making work that I want to buy a print of that thing now because it's become a famous image.
Right.
Yeah, it becomes this commercialized thing.
That feel to McCullen himself? Let's say you were fortunate enough to have him come to your house for a dinner party, and here on your wall is this piece of art, and I've got my quotes.
Yep.
And it's his photograph of this.
And not the normal art in quotes that we use, but rather something really serious that you're now looking at as something...
I was going to say
inconsequential as art.
Yeah. It's like, would he want to just tear it down and go, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
This is not an image to be, you know, fawned over or gawked at. This is it's a really fascinating.
But at the same time, isn't that exactly what it's there for?
Yeah. I mean, I think within the context of or within the framework, I guess, of contextualizing the war, but 30, 40, 50 years on, is there value in going back to it?
You know, you and I often talk about how you can't control how people react to your art, whether they think it's good, whether they think it's bad. But there's also this deeper thing of you could make something really serious that somebody else finds funny, or... You know, you could make something that you think is impactful that somebody else thinks is superfluous, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he was trying to be ironic with these photographs. No.
Not to say that, but I'm just saying that, you know, you may want somebody to feel a certain way when they look at it, but you can't guarantee that. That's not the way it works, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think in photographs, because it's a single image, a sort of moment in time, I think it's harder to control people's emotions than it is, say, during a narrative movie or something, right? Where time passing and you can manipulate somebody in another dimension, like a third dimension of time. And, you know, yeah, and here you are 80 years old, or, you know, let's just say 80 years old. You don't have enough time to... Even if assuming you know what it is that you should have done with your life, if this is in the end a waste, you now don't have enough time to do all that over again.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could do what you can and go shoot what you want for the rest of your life, but it's not like you have another 50 years to go build another giant body of work. You know, I wonder how many artists... Not only because we assume all the time that, oh, he or she got to be an artist their entire life, and what a wonderful thing. I wonder how many people who are older stop and look at the idea of, yeah, I made stuff, and well, what's the hell the point of that?
Mm-hmm.
You and I never imagine that that's a reaction somebody could have, but it's got to be, right?
Yeah,
you know, I should have spent more time, whatever, building a company, making money. Spend more time with my family. You know, the famous interview with Avedon and Charlie Rose that you and I talked about early on in this thing, where Avedon said, you know, if I had anything to do over again, I wouldn't have had a family. You can't do both well. I would have chosen to do my work better. You know, and
yeah, and see, and that's fascinating to me that I mean, how do you as sons who have had at points tumultuous relationship with their fathers,
yeah,
how does that have to make his son feel?
Oh,
like if I had it to do over again,
I wouldn't have had kids.
I wouldn't have had a family.
Yeah, somebody said that to me the other day,
because the work was more important.
Yeah, and I during my first 365, there was a kid who asked. I shot him, and he's like, "Oh, you should shoot my mother." And we went over to his mom's house. This older Asian woman.
Phrasing.
What's that?
Phrasing.
Oh, shoot my mother. You should come over and photograph my mother. And we went over to her house, and the three of us are sitting there, and I'm always fascinated by older people and kind of want to know where they think they went right and wrong. And if they have any particular advice or anything, you know? So I said, you know, is there anything you would have done differently? And she said, I don't think I would have had kids. And her son is sitting like 5 feet away.
Yeah. I can hear you.
Yeah. And it was a little bit of that kind of comment from him. He did not suddenly disappear into a small hole in the floor, you know. I probably,
but there's a part of you that wants to.
Sure, sure. But I mean, I guess we all have regrets. I guess if we all have small regrets. I guess the question is, what do you do when you have large regrets? You know? Mm-hmm. Especially in the sense of someone, you and I are so lucky to be sitting here in front of these microphones talking to people. We're so lucky to be able to make enough money to eat doing what it is that we do, you know, or have the opportunity to do that at all. You know, for me to not have had a jobby job, as they say, for the last 20 years is incredibly fortunate for all kinds of reasons that, you know, I was born in the right place with the right color skin with the parents who had enough money to put me through school. You know, all of those privileged opportunities, right, that I've mm-hmm. taken advantage of. But even inside of all that, you know, I always wonder, you know, does anything that I'm doing really matter? You know, am I going to be satisfied when I'm old with what I've accomplished, whether right. or not I'm successful at it? You know, almost the question becomes more acute if you are successful at it, because people assume it's a little bit of the Anthony Bourdain thing, you know? It's like, you have everything. Well, apparently he didn't think he had everything, you know? Apparently he didn't feel that way.
Yeah, I mean, look, yeah,
I mean, I'm not inside of his head, but I could imagine that that's an element of it. Otherwise, you know, that's the kind of stuff that goes through your head. And so the feelings of purpose, you know, I was listening to Jordan Peterson was on Joe Rogan, this guy who is a real, you know, lightning rod for a lot of people. So I'm not going to get into his politics or the things he has to say. But one of his things was, look, it's not about being happy. It's about having purpose in life. So it's about finding something that gives you purpose. And that's where happiness comes from. It's not superficial happiness, it's purpose. That's what makes people happy. And I think we're somewhat wired for that. So it's, oh, I'm here to take care of those around me, or I'm here to fight a war, and so I care about my tribe, and whatever it is, right? That's where we're sort of bred to have purpose that way. And I think somebody like Don is looking at it and saying, my purpose is to, you know, experience this horror of war and explain it to other people so that maybe it won't happen again. You know, something along those lines. I
don't know that he's got any illusions that it's not going to happen again. But I think that there's a... there's, you know, there's that thing of if I knew what I knew now, would I do it the same way?
Right. Okay, yeah.
You know, and I think that's kind of where he's at, where, again, speculating based on what we know, I don't know, man. I hurt for him because I know he's proud of his work, but there's also, what could I have done different? What could I have done better? How could I have served instead of, you know, differently, instead of documenting simply the horrors of war. Yeah. I don't know. It's a very strange conundrum to be faced with.
And I think that you and I are also hypersensitive to regret as a motivating factor. You know, that
certainly recognizing it. Yeah.
Yeah. Or avoiding future regret. Or at least I think that's one of my things, you know.
Yeah, again, recognizing it. I don't really deal with regret much.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm dealing with future regret, which is a really strange thing. I'm worried that in the future I'm going to regret things that I haven't yet done, or regret things that I did instead of doing the things that I did. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm fearful for wasting my time here on Earth. That's my big fear. Whatever that means.
Yeah, but the irony is that it is often in wasting. Well, yeah, in wasting time is where ideas come from.
Right.
You know, I mean, how many people will tell you that great ideas happen when you're not thinking about them? They happen when you're in the shower or taking a walk or you know, letting your brain not have to focus, and something creeps in, and that's the aha moment.
Yep, you're in the tub. Yeah, exactly. Man, poor Don. I mean, it's one quote out of an article, you know. Who knows if that is an element of how he thinks, and the rest of the time he's very proud of his work, or if this is a very overarching kind of foreboding sense, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've read a couple interviews. I've seen a couple things on YouTube, but I find myself, and this happens actually quite a bit, where I'm either reading or watching, going, ask this, or dive a little deeper on this, or man, you completely missed an opportunity. He was leaving an opening for this, or she was leaving an opening for this, and you could have gone here.
Do you think that it is? How long do you need to talk to somebody in order to understand, have some deeper understanding of them? Obviously, a five-minute conversation.
That's a giant conversation.
Yeah. You know, but I mean, you have an hour-long talk with somebody, or I have an hour-long talk with somebody. You and I have talked to each other for how many hours is it? 600 hours or 500 hours?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think you and I probably know each other as well as almost anybody in our lives, you know, at some
maybe
level.
I mean, we don't spend a lot of time deep diving each other than how it is relevant to the show.
Right. True.
You
True.
Know? I mean, when I'm doing an episode of PD, I mean, it's one of the reasons that I insist on doing the pre-calls is A, as a form of introduction, but B, it allows me to hear your cadence. It allows me to hear, are you one of these people that talks like this all the time? Yep. Or are you more introspective? Are there pauses? So that I can more effectively kind of match and mirror where you are so that you feel comfortable, so that you feel like we're kind of in the same zone. And then I do my research, and the research is what I really love.
Do I need to give you time to formulate an answer and not rush you? Or do you need to be pushed in order to,
you know, and I have always kind of adhered to the belief that, you know, I just want to get you to where you need to go to feel comfortable to tell your stories and to share a conversation, because what I don't want to do is go in with some sort of preconceived notion about what you want to talk about, or worse still is, you know, take the like, you know, E Hollywood, like Jerry Penicoli route of, well, I want to know this, this, and this, regardless of what you feel like talking about, because that's completely disrespectful to your guest.
Yeah. But at the same time, if what they're giving you is what they want to give you, then are you really getting something, or are you getting, you know, the version of them that they want to portray, you know?
Well, I mean, look, obviously it depends on the person that you're talking to, but you know, in the case of some of these junket type things where you've got 5 minutes with somebody and they're asked the same questions over and over again, you know, Jude and I were talking about this, and he said, you know, I was doing this thing and I was talking to Courtney Cox, and we were just talking. I had 5 minutes with her, but we just started talking, and you know, her publicist came in. We weren't, you know, I wasn't asking her about her project, and I wasn't asking. We were just connecting as human beings. And her publicist came in and said, "All right, time's up. and you know, ask it, you know, wrap it up kind of thing. And Courtney was like, no, no, no. He gets as much time as he wants. Right. And they just sat there and continued talking for another 45 minutes, right. You know, because there was this connection, there was an authenticity, there was a real inquisitiveness. And, you know, so to answer your question, how long does it take? You can't answer that because how long does it take for that person to get comfortable? What are you talking about? Are there things, you know,
I don't expect that there's a hard and fast rule. I'm just wondering, do you think that if you talk to somebody for obviously a long form interview of a couple hours or something, you're going to get more than you're going to get in 5 minutes, but do you really, you know, you don't know that person like their best friend does, you know?
No, nor do I want to.
Right.
Not in that conversation anyway. No,
right. It's these sort of layers of onions of people. I mean, you and I meet listeners. I mean, look at all the listeners who have sent us emails. By the way, thank you for another couple dozen emails in the last week from people saying very, very nice things to us. But, you know, they know us as, if you and I know each other at a certain level, they know a more superficial level than that. You know?
It is cultivating a relationship. You know, most of the people that I have talked to, I still talk to.
Yeah.
You know, I got a phone call out of the blue the other day from John Keatley just saying, hey man, haven't talked to you in a while and you know, been thinking about you, what's going on? And we sat and had a conversation for an hour.
Right.
And I think that is kind of indicative of where I want PD to go. I don't want to just have one conversation with you and forget about it. I want to connect with you again and go, okay, well, we did the origin story, or at least we did our origin story. So what's going on? What are you up to?
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather take the Carson or the Letterman model of having people on again and again and see where you're at and what you're doing and what you want to talk about. And because you're interesting and I'm interested in you.
Yeah. And how do you stop that from becoming like a press junkety kind of, oh, here's the bullet points I have to hit to get the word out about this thing that I'm working on?
Well, one, I don't have any bullet points, and two, I'm really good at what I do.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I mean, I think if there's a sort of a hierarchy of skills, I think conversation is way up there for me.
Mm-hmm.
And again, because I'm interested in you, because I do my homework, because I don't want to ask the same questions or talk about the same things that you've already talked about 50 times, because if it's boring for you, it's going to be boring for a listener.
Yeah, sure.
You know? I don't know.
Don McCullen.
If you don't know his work, go check him out. Or go spend $1,500 and buy that 3-volume set.
We've got a couple quick news hits here. Vice article, Leila Amatulla Barian.
I think that's probably
as close as I'm going to get.
Yeah. Interesting article about some female photographers in the African diaspora, which I did not know this word. I had to look it up.
Diaspora.
And diaspora.
Yep.
And it is a collection of communities of African descent in the Americas.
Yeah.
Is that a good way to put that?
Sure. Yep.
Article on this woman who is celebrating female photographers. And I just found it really interesting. There's some terrific work in there. And I'm always looking for new people to let into my filter and inspire me. And so I just thought this was really cool.
Yeah. Really beautiful stuff here. It's really interesting. When I was talking to Bun yesterday, he was talking about how my friend Bun, who came over from Cambodia, how there are Cambodian sort of enclaves in certain cities. He was saying Lowell, Massachusetts and Philadelphia were big, and the Bronx. And then they ended up in Harrisburg. And that
Pennsylvania, Harrison?
Yeah, that's where he grew up. But that there are Laotian, concentrations in other places, like in, it wasn't Iowa, it was like somewhere Illinois or something like that, where it's in some ways it's both where I think people are placed sometimes when they're refugees, and also where the first person in a group came and then more people from their family or their village or whatever came over and will move into a very specific area. So it's strange that there's, oh, here we are in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and there's a Cambodian sub sort of area, you know what I mean?
Right.
A community of Cambodians in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. It's like, well, how the hell did they end up in Harrisburg? And there's whole stories behind that, you know? And I feel like this article, the Vice stuff, is very similar to that. Like, okay, here we are, people moving to different places and staying in these communities within those places and the tight-knit stuff that happens with them. There's a lot of like Korean organizations here in New York.
Oh, wow.
You know, that are pretty cool. Anyway, interesting stuff. So we'll put that one on the show notes. And I also somehow this popped into one of my feeds where this guy cut what looked like perfect slices of fruit. I don't know how he did this, like a laser cutter or something like that.
His knife skills are impeccable.
Yeah. Could you imagine? Look how perfect. How many slices of lime do you have to make in order to get one that looks that perfect? You know, that's that symmetrical and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So he shot limes and melons and kiwis and apples and stuff, and then lights them from behind. So they end up almost looking like stained glass windows, slices of watermelon.
You know, these aren't photographs, right?
Yeah, I know. They're paintings. But I'm sure he started from photographs, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, but like just the beginnings of it, though. You know what I mean? Like how do you even create that? You know, I guess he could idealize it. He could idealize it in the painting. You know, maybe he fixes a bunch of stuff, but still.
The one looks like an eyeball, the Rosette series, number 15.
Yeah, which one's 15?
Right below the kiwi.
Right below the kiwi. Oh, yeah. Is this the kind of thing that I guess I put it in here not just because it's very well done work, you know what I mean? Like, obviously, whoever this person is, what was the name again? I just said it and I missed it.
Dennis Wojcikowicz?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Wojcikowicz? Wojcikowicz.
And we'll put a link to his work too, yeah. But obviously, this guy is slicing and shooting because they are photorealistic. So he's one of those guys who's working off a photograph almost guaranteed, you know? But you know, that the most simple of subjects is the reason why I put it in here can turn out to be a really interesting thing. Like, well, all I've got to shoot is this apple. Well, I guess I'll shoot the apple. It's like, well, have you considered slicing the apple and shooting that? Or, you know what I mean? Like there's manipulations you can make of things. There's always something to shoot. If you go small enough, if you start, you know, if you think structurally or you think light and shadow versus color, you know, if you break it down, you can find some place where you can find something to hold on to and then build from there. You know, these are big too. Look at that. 30 by 60 inches, 48 inches, 4 by 4 foot paintings of these things, Jeffrey.
That's a lot of paint.
If you've never been a big, photorealism kind of painter guy.
I don't have the skill for it.
Yeah. That's a very specific thing.
I don't have anywhere close to the skill.
And again, I wonder if, you know, this seems like the kind of thing that's only really happened in the last half century or so. You know, the photorealistic painting thing, because you don't see a lot of paintings from the 19th century that are photorealistic.
No, you don't.
I wonder if that's just photography got common enough that, you know.
Where did I see this? Oh, man. Where did I see it? It's this little boy. It's this little African-American boy. And I think he's like 10 or 11 years old. But he does these incredible photorealistic drawings.
Okay.
Let me see if this is...
Man, there's this cool phone booth one of Richard Estes did of these phone booths in 1968. Wow, that's a cool picture. Or a painting, rather. Wow. Anyway, sorry.
I'll find it and put it in the thing for next time. But incredible. Really incredible. I think he's 11 years old or 12 years old or something. But really wonderful stuff.
I'm going to start learning how to draw, I think.
You should. If nothing else, it's relaxing.
You find it relaxing?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe that's what I need to do.
I found it even more relaxing when I was better at it. I had, do we have a little bit of time?
Yeah, sure.
Got nothing yesterday, but time. Yeah. Yesterday, I spoke to a friend of mine from college who I hadn't talked to in a number of years, but he, and this has been bouncing around my head for a while. He told me that my advisor, my tech advisor, and the head of the department, the head of the tech department anyway, had passed away last year.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah.
And a mentor, but not in the way that we usually think of mentors. But the talent that he had, scenic and costume drawings and renderings were incredible, mm-hmm. without equal. I've never seen anyone better. But the thing that was even more amazing about it, Bill, is if he was trying to explain something to you and you're sitting across the table from him, he would draw these beautiful costume renderings upside down so that they're right side up for you across the table. Or these beautiful Show scenic off. Renderings. Just like, here's what you want to do. You have this and he would come up with this beautiful scenic rendering completely upside down.
Ah, screw that guy.
Yeah. 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 So, but it again,
it's like, I can't fit my hand in that corner. I'll just switch hands and finish the drawing with the other hand. That's right. Like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And I mean, he would do, as I said, costume renderings, set renderings. He was a director. He was a fine artist. I mean, the guy was just incredibly talented and didn't give you what you wanted, but gave you what you needed.
Like the best women in the world.
Ugh. Why is what is wrong with you?
Is that something that frustrated you at the time?
His ability?
No, that he gave you what you needed, not what you wanted.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Because I was a 20-something arrogant prick. So of right. course it did.
Right. Yeah.
Of course it did. But he was also responsible for a lesson in hubris that would change my life,
right,
for the better. And you know, that was in finding out that he had passed. I was saddened because I would love to have, and I've wanted to do this over the years. I've wanted to reach out to him and thank him, and
never got around to it.
I never got around to it. You know, I always put it off, you know, I just wanted to tell him. In hindsight, what it meant and who it allowed me to become.
Right. Are there other people in your life that you haven't said that to that you should?
No, I don't think so. I think I've tried to be really good about sort of wearing my heart on my sleeve in that way and letting the people in my life who I care about and who care about me know that I either care about them or I appreciate their, you know, thoughts and affections or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I try not to be because there have been a couple times where it's not necessarily a regret, but you go, oh man, I wish I would have.
Sure.
Wish I would have done that.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. It's tricky. To get overcoming that hump. I asked a question the other day with some friends about if you have to make a phone call that, you know, is going to be a little bit awkward, whether because you're calling to somebody to tell them that you love them, or you're calling somebody to tell them that you're quitting your job, or you know what I mean? Whatever the sort of slightly awkward conversation you have to have is, do you have to build up to that? Is that difficult for you? And both of them were just like, yep, hate doing that. You know, it's like, do you have to think about what you say, or is it better just to dive in, you know, in those situations? I don't know what the answer is, but I always found that interesting. Cause I used to have a really hard time making those calls. And now I'm just like, well, you're going to make it now or you're going to make it later. Why are you putting off what is going to be, if it's going to be an awkward conversation, get it over with now. It's not going to get any better the longer you let it wait, you know, it's
right,
going to fester.
Right.
So you might as well just make it happen, you know? Yeah, it's interesting. Let's talk about Jiggity FreshBooks possibly for the last time.
What?
Jiggity FreshBooks.
Fresher books. I don't know.
I think you should do that one at the end too.
Right? FreshBooks.
Our friends at FreshBooks. What? You done doing your FreshBooks thing?
My knuckleheadedness.
Oh, yeah. Our friends at FreshBooks make ridiculously easy cloud accounting software for freelancers, and they build amazing online invoicing, expense tracking, online payment software. FreshBooks has been drastically reducing the time that it takes over 10 million people to deal with their paperwork every single day. If that's not enough incentive, Jeffrey, to save all, a lot of time in your schedule, FreshBooks platform has been completely rebuilt from the ground up. They've taken simplicity and speed to an entirely new level and added powerful new features. And, you know, they're going to save you about 2 working days per month that you can use for other stuff, like building your business instead of...
Which equates to like 187 hours a day.
It is. So, I mean, it's 187 hours a day.
187 hours a day is what you're going to save.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. And you know what? And you get to sleep that entire extra time too, if you really want to.
You can sleep while you're saving. That's the beauty of it.
Send clean, professional looking invoices in about 30 seconds. With literally 2 clicks, you can set yourself up to receive payments online. You can take pictures of receipts on your phone using your FreshBooks mobile app and make claiming your expenses a million times easier. They've got a new projects feature which lets you share files and messages with your clients, contractors, and employees, and you can see everything all in one place. Stuff will get done faster, better, with less screw-ups and less miscommunication. They've got a new notification center, which is like your personal assistant. You'll know what's changed in your business since you last logged on, what needs to be dealt with pronto, like overdue invoices, which, by the way, it also already sends out automated late payment reminders. So FreshBooks helps you avoid having to have that awkward talk with your client about past due payments. So it automates late payment reminders so you can spend more time working on your business. They've got great, amazing support, award-winning customer service that's amazingly helpful, super friendly, with zero attitude, plus a real-life person answers in 3 rings or less. So go try out FreshBooks. If you're listening to this and you're not using FreshBooks yet, now would be the time to try. FreshBooks is offering an unrestricted 30-day free trial for all of the On Taking Pictures listeners. No credit card is required. All you have to do is go to FreshBooks.com/On Taking Pictures. I'm reading it and I'm shortening On Taking Pictures to OTP. See, that's what happens when you do this for 324 episodes. Are. FreshBooks.com/On Taking Pictures. Enter On Taking Pictures in the How Did You Hear From Us section. And, you will support the show. What are we going to say? You're going to make fun of me?
Never.
We both know that's not true.
Was that not convincing? Hold on.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
No, wait.
No, one
hold
more.
Hold on. I got one more in me.
Yeah.
Never.
Hey, have you watched The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
I have. I told you about it.
I don't remember your conversation about it. Sorry. I watched the first 15 minutes of the first episode once and I was like, I don't like this. And then I watched 3 episodes last night, and once it got past the, you know, big thing that happens in the first episode, I was like, oh, this is getting much better very quickly.
I thought it was fun.
Yeah, it just, like, the whole, you know, good wife annoying husband thing was too cute by a half for the first
too close to home.
No, it wasn't that. It was
you're the annoying husband.
Oh my god, I am. Bum bum bum.
I like the guy who plays Lenny Bruce too.
Yeah, he's pretty good. Is it weird having Lenny Bruce as a character in a narrative thing like that?
Not for me. I don't know anything really about him other than, you know, what little I've you know, gleaned over the years. Yeah. And
I like the one who the lesbian lady who plays her manager, the little one. She's pretty great.
Oh, yeah.
She's Lois on the Family
Guy.
Yeah,
she's Lois on Family Guy. Alex, oh my God, what's her last name? Lois Family
Lois.
Guy. Alice Borstein.
Yeah, there's
Alex Borstein.
I think it's Alex, I think, isn't it?
Alex Borstein.
It's an androgynous name, yeah.
Yeah, she's got a terrific talent. I think she is funny as hell.
Her character is the best part of that show, in my opinion, or at least in the 3 episodes I've watched. Anyway, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. If you haven't seen it, I've been converted. All right, so I was listening to a podcast yesterday. What are you laughing about?
Nothing. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was listening to a podcast yesterday. I listened to this Backstory podcast. Have you listened to this? You've listened to this.
I have heard Backstory many times, yes.
Okay.
So I probably do not listen as much as you do, but I've heard a number of episodes.
Yes. Yeah, I'm behind a few episodes, which is why I listened to this episode from June 15th the other day. Episode 241, amateurs, is called The Camera Never Lies.
Contempt.
It's called The Camera Never Lies, History Through the Viewfinder.
Right.
And they have like three segments, one where they talk about this set of daguerreotypes that this woman, this crazy story of this curator at the Amon Carter Center at the time down in Fort Worth, where my friend Kristen just moved to this last week, got a call from some guy who said he had daguerreotypes. He wouldn't bring them in to show her. He asked to meet her at an airport or something like that. And they ended up meeting at an airport. He
meet
had
me
daguerreotypes.
By the dumpster behind the American terminal.
Jeffrey, he had like daguerreotypes that were completely priceless and whatever, like ones that weren't in, that they didn't have other, obviously no more copies of, but stuff that they hadn't seen before. And he had them wrapped in paper towel in a bag.
Sure.
Yeah. Because, you know,
as one does,
it's not like they're fragile or anything.
No, no.
I
put them in between sheets of 200 grit sandpaper. I hope that's okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then the second artist story was about a guy named William Mumler who made Civil War era photographs with spirits in them for people, so that it's like, look, it's your son behind you, whatever. Yeah, that kind of thing. You know, are you making scary sounds?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, good. Which was actually
you interrupted. I was just about to bust into my no windows and no doors. So thanks for that.
Oh, wait, one more time. Come on, give me the one.
No. I'm done with you.
Okay. Well, he apparently was sued because people started figuring out that the ghosts in his thing were still alive and seen walking around town. Yeah.
Whoops.
Yeah. Up in Boston.
Wait a minute. You're not dead.
Wait. Yeah. And so he got sued, brought into court. And basically, even though they had photographic experts who came in and said, if I was going to do this, this is how I would pull off this effect, no one actually ever saw him doing whatever he did exactly to do it. Whether he shot plates with the people on them before, and so when people came and shot, they just took one picture and then he went and developed it, and there it was with the other person on it. Or whether he was doing some sort of double exposure, or whether he, or, you know, in the dark room, you know, like layering plates or something like that.
Right, right, right.
But so he got off because they said, you know, if electricity can do all these things that we didn't know it could do 50 years ago, how do you know photography can't capture spirits? And can you prove
right.
it? And so he got off.
Like the Curlian photography where it's capturing your aura.
Exactly. That kind of crazy crap. Anyway, the third story, which is the reason why I bring it up, is a guy named Alfred Stanley Johnson, who in the early 20th century made crazy postcard photo montages of people out west in these small towns, you know, cutting ears of corn like tree trunks.
Yeah.
And, you know, giant onions and wheelbarrows and, you know, kids on giant pigs and all this kind of stuff. So they were called, excuse me.
You're right.
They were called tall tale postcards. And
nice.
This guy was doing this stuff, you know, in the dark room back in the stuff. And I think we may have mentioned this guy when we, what's the book that from the MoMA show?
Faking It. I just put a link under those links.
Thank you.
Yeah. Faking It, Manipulated Photography Before Photoshop. A terrific book, by the way. I have it. I love it. It's very, very good.
Yeah. So, you know, this stuff has existed and you guys have seen this, but I just thought this was a really good example of the kind of work that people used to do. And it's a little bit of a, what is the word? Novelty, I guess, is the word they use to describe,
yeah.
you know.
Well, I mean, look, you've got to look at this thing through sort of the Victorian sensibility, right?
Right.
I mean, we look at it and go, oh my God, that looks awful.
Yeah.
But we, you know, go back to your own childhood. You looked at Star Wars and went, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Exactly. Right.
But now you look at it and go, eh, it's okay.
Well, and so the woman that they talked to, historian and radio producer Erica Janik, delights in the work of this Wisconsin wizard, where they talk to this woman and she says, you know, I show these images to kids in my class and they don't understand how this was done before Photoshop. You know, and it's like, well, people did this kind of stuff all the time before Photoshop. You know, they would make prints, they would cut things out, they'd re-photograph, or they'd do things in the darkroom.
Sure,
or, you know,
sure.
And the tricks of doing this kind of stuff where, okay, I'm going to shoot this thing closer up in wide angle to fit at the same space as this thing, which is small at a longer lens, to create these perspective illusions. Because you can't just shoot the same thing with the same focal length and make it bigger and have it look right. It's got to fit into the picture, the other picture. So this guy figured all this stuff out, and that's all stuff you could do in the old analog, you know, world. So
yeah.
I just thought this guy was a fun, different guy. For our stuff, the JoyceTease.com article has a bunch of them, and they say Tri-County's genealogy and history by Joyce Tease, humorous exaggeration postcards, giant vegetable postcards by Alfred Stanley Johnson, and just you know four girls holding up a watermelon thing and eating off of it, and that kind
melon
of,
party. That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway,
there's
kind of fun.
Sylvia is doing basketball camp.
Okay.
And the school that she is doing it is an arts school here in.
So they're not actually playing basketball. They're painting basketballs with.
No. They're playing basketball, but the school itself is an arts school. Still have a chemical darkroom.
Really?
And still teaching chemical analog photography.
That's pretty cool. Is it older school?
It's not that old. Grades 4 through 12, but the school was started by, from what I understand, was started by a painter. So the arts programs are integral to the entire curriculum.
Did you have a dark room in your middle school?
You know, I don't know. I know we had one in high school. We had a computer lab in middle school. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I didn't go in a dark room in high school, but we actually had one in middle school because one of these seventh grade teachers, I do believe her name was Mrs. Nash, although I might be wrong on that. So it had one of those spinning doors, you know, like the,
Yep.
And it was like inside the library's office, you could go into the dark room and you had to be, you know, a very small photo club that had access to that kind of stuff. But and now looking back, I wish I had done it earlier, you know, one of those kinds of scenarios.
Sure.
But yeah. So anyway, very cool. Wait, this isn't the school she goes to though.
No. She's just doing this for camp, for this week for camp.
Yeah. Wait, what grade is she going into next year?
Seventh.
Oh, I remember seventh grade. Yeah. I feel for you.
We were talking. She's an avid reader. Loves to read. Reads faster than you and I put together, and retains it all. It's incredible.
Nerd.
Right. But we were talking about, you know, in junior high was where I really learned to appreciate books and language and storytelling, and it was my English teacher. We read three books by S.E. Hinton. We read The Outsiders, That Was Then, This Is Now, and Rumblefish. And those three books just turned my head around on good storytelling and good characters and phenomenal books. So we're going to watch The Outsiders, and then if she likes it, she's going to go ahead and read the books.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. She's going to read the books that you loved.
Yeah.
She's going to be like, these suck.
I know, right?
Yeah, she's gonna be like, you thought these were good?
Ugh. Can't even believe you like this.
Yeah, kids nowadays. I'm just gonna go listen to Drake.
Yeah, right. Drake. Now she's actually into like pop and EDM.
Okay.
She really likes like dance music.
I get it, but
I think it's the rhythm that she likes. She likes the, you know, the beats. Yeah.
I get that. So next week, last episode, we need lots and lots of pictures. Or pictures. We need lots and lots of questions.
What? Wait, what now?
I'm staring at photographs.
We're making a fabulous collage, so yeah. Please send in your 4x6s.
It's going to be like the AIDS quilt, except it's going to be the entire, you know.
Right. It's 17 football fields of listener photos,
yeah.
And it's going to be lovely.
No, we need questions for the last episode, Q&A episode. So send in your questions, podcast@ontakingpictures.com, or leave a voicemail, 347-687-9411. We'll leave us a voicemail. We love voicemail questions. Those are super fun.
Yeah.
And let's see. Jeffrey, you have a new process-driven episode out, right?
Out last week. New iteration going up this week. Also, prints of select paintings are going up tomorrow. So for the dozens, nay, hundreds of you that have liked and requested and wanted to know when and where, they will be at jeffreysidoris.com starting tomorrow.
How much are you charging for those?
Well, you're just going to have to go see, aren't you? I can't spoil everything. $10 million. But they are gift wrapped.
I will put a link to the new one with Jude because that's a
That's a good one. That's a good.
I have yet to listen, so I need to listen to that. Let's see what else. If you, I've actually put up two episodes of my little interview show with my friends that I'm doing for fun. Yeah, I did one last Wednesday, and then I ended up doing one yesterday, and I finished it. So this week's went up early.
Nice.
It's just, I'm going to try to do one a week. It's about scheduling and all the rest of it. But again, this is just, I know lots of interesting people. So this is just interviews with friends of mine. So
too
I did
bad
one.
They don't.
But I did one with my friend Molly Goldstein, who's a film editor last week. And she has a new thing that she just worked on that's coming out on Netflix in a few weeks. And we talk about, you know, her journey to becoming a film editor and what that's like in New York City and in the world. And then my friend Bun Chem, who's a chef, executive chef here at a number of restaurants. And I talk about being a chef and food and, you know, going from a refugee camp in Thailand to being an executive chef in New York, which is a fun little conversation. So you can go listen to those, Pals with Bill Wadman. You can go find it wherever these things are. Is that it? Got anything else?
I think that's it. Yeah, that's all I can think
of.
Man,
I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to prepare for next week.
I'm going to do shots, and I'm going to start at about 7:30.
I think you should, yeah.
So
could you please
be
drunk for the entire thing?
I think I'm going to be hammered for the entire episode.
And be more or less insufferable than normal.
I don't know. Could go either way.
Guess we'll find out.
Could go either way.
All right, everyone. We will talk to you next week. This is the last time I'm saying that. That's a weird thing.
I know. Last show. Go out and be good to each other. Have fun.
Yep.
Talk to you next week.
We'll see you later.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. As this way. Say, will leave me out.